Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to the Rose Report. On this episode, we're going to be discussing police powers and free speech in light of the recent events of the last few weeks. But first, I just want to take a moment to acknowledge the difficult climate we're in. There's no doubt that much of the country is experiencing hardship in one form or another in the aftermath of the recent events following the death of George Floyd. This episode aims to outline and explain the legal issues embedded in the events following the death of George Floyd, and we will do that by splitting this episode into two parts. So the first part is going to discuss police powers, and the second part will go over freedom of speech. Joining us today as our featured guest is Rose Law Group partner Logan Elia. Hey, Logan. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, Wafa. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. Now, Logan is going to field questions from me, Dan, and Olin, whatever we ask of him, essentially. But none of this content on this episode or any of the other episodes affiliated with the Rose Report is to be taken as legal advice. We just really aim to outline the legal aspects of these recent events so that you, our listener, has a better understanding of what's really going on in that sense. And with that, I'm going to toss it over to Dan for a quick welcome, followed by Olin, and then I'm going to paint the scene and introduce Logan.
Thanks, Wafa, and welcome back to our listeners that are continuing from one of our prior episodes, and welcome to new listeners that may be listening to this episode as their first one. We are very excited to have Logan on the podcast today to talk about these extremely what I'll call hot issues right now, and we'll pull out some interesting legal topics to talk about and hopefully have a fun discussion for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited about today's episode. I've probably spent more time discussing and prepping with Dan and Logan for this episode than I normally would have, just because of how unique and interesting to me the last few weeks have been. I think we're going to really have an interesting episode discussing both of the protesting and the citizen side of it, as well as the authority and the police side of things and the rights and responsibilities both sides have to each other and themselves, and any sort of remedies or ramifications of the actions or non-actions that those parties take.
All right. Thanks, Dan and Olin, for that. Now I just want to give you some context and just paint the scene for you in terms of our subject matter, starting with a quick recap. So on May 25th, four police officers responded to a report of a man using a counterfeit bill at a store in South Minneapolis, Minnesota. That man was 46-year-old George Floyd. Floyd was arrested and he ultimately died while in custody after Officer Derek Chauvin kneeled on his neck for 9 minutes, all while Floyd was pleading that he couldn't breathe. Meanwhile, bystanders outside the store were demanding that the officer take his knee off his neck. But instead, Chauvin continued to apply pressure to Floyd's neck, and his fellow officers did absolutely nothing to stop him, ultimately leading to Floyd's death on that street in South Minneapolis. This incident sparked widespread unrest across the country as people demanded for the four officers involved to be arrested and charged. Since then, the four officers have been fired and are facing charges. Chauvin was charged with second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. The other three cops, or I should say ex-cops, who are at the scene are being charged with aiding and abetting. Now, police and prosecutors are continuing to investigate the situation. I'm sure you've heard about this in the news. But now that you have a brief background, I just want to talk a little bit about our guest, Rose Law Group partner, Logan Elia. So Logan has a very diverse practice that includes years of experience in business litigation, intellectual property law, cyber law, medical cannabis litigation, and appellate practice. In addition, Logan leverages his courtroom experience, some of which he gained working as a prosecutor, to assist his clients in criminal defense, adversarial bankruptcy proceedings, and construction law. Logan, do you want to go ahead and just introduce yourself to us?
Sure. My name is Logan Elia. I'm an attorney at the Rose Law Group. Like you said, I've had a maybe unusually diverse litigation practice, including criminal defense and most aspects of civil practice. Predominantly, I'm a civil practitioner. I do mostly civil litigation. I represent businesses, I represent homeowners, I do breach of contract disputes, but I also do a bit of criminal defense work. When I was in law school, I interned at a prosecutor's office in Anchorage, Alaska, and I enjoyed that. And shortly after law school, I worked as a prosecutor through a firm that I was working at in the town of Buckeye doing municipal prosecutions. And I found that I enjoy criminal law. And so I continue to do it as a part of my practice.
That's awesome. Thanks for that. So now we're going to dive into the first part of the episode, which will cover protesting and police powers. As many of you know, there have been widespread protests across the country in the aftermath of George Floyd's death. Protesting is a fundamental part of our democracy. It's a protected form of free speech under the First Amendment in the Constitution. Along with this protesting, there has also been widespread looting and destruction of infrastructure across the country, which has sparked increased law enforcement and even military presence on some streets around the nation. Now, it's really important that we draw a line and differentiate between protesting and looting. They are not the same, and they are not to be confused. Many people who are out protesting for equality and increased police accountability have been very vocal about not supporting looting or the destruction of businesses. So it's important that we don't confuse the two. With that, we're going to go ahead and get right into it.
Thanks, Wafa. So, Logan, I think the first thing I want to address is the protester side of things. And obviously, protests are happening en masse all across the country. And I think it's important for our listeners, who some of them may be part of these protests, to know what their rights and responsibilities are if they're joining in. Can you briefly discuss what they need to be concerned about in terms of being detained, arrested, what constitutes their ability to have the police approach them, what they should have on them in terms of ID, general questions like that?
Wow. Well, as Wafa mentioned earlier, I think there's a distinction between peaceful protesting and looting. And the question actually becomes more complicated because both of those things have been occurring simultaneously. Generally speaking, people have the right to peacefully assemble, the right to free speech, that broadly forms the framework of our right to protest. And people engaged in peaceful protest should be generally assured in their safety and feel comfortable in their ability to do that. However, protests frequently involve doing things that interfere with the peaceful order of society. One of the things that's almost certain to occur is street closure. It's not the case that citizens have the right to close streets just on a whim. Protests that are closing down streets that are not permitted should probably expect to receive some police response. Ideally, a protest will be planned, it'll be permitted, the police will be notified, and they'll be on site, and the police will actually provide protection for the protesters who are engaging in really legitimate, important political speech and ensure that there's no violence that's occurring. As I said earlier, when the protests become mixed in with rioting or looting, I think it's very difficult, although it's very difficult to distinguish the two. Although, certainly, they're distinguishable from the perspective of an individual protester. It's not immediately clear to me that they're distinguishable readily from the perspective of law enforcement. That's when you'll see law enforcement begin to treat protesters as though they're looters or rioters. That's a really horrible outcome. So I don't know if that answers the question, but that's sort of the beginning of my thoughts on the subject.
No, that's great. I think it definitely paints the general scope of what's occurring and how, we're seeing what is deemed to be a peaceful protest, and then there's police escalation, and it's clear that maybe there's some things we're not seeing behind the scenes where there is one form or another of illegal activity, which forces the police who are present for the benefit of the protesters to then start to, you know, I guess, for lack of a better word, turn on them and start to enforce the laws that they see that are now being broken.
So one argument that I've heard being made, you know, at least, you know, on a fairly widespread basis, is that in connection with, you know, let's set aside looting and, you know, rioting for just a moment and say for peaceful protesting that, you know, in some areas across the country, there may be too much police involvement or, you know, if the military is involved, you know, too much involvement of the police or military. And as a result of that, the protest ends up turning into, maybe not solely because of that, but it turns into a riot or something that, moves farther away from a peaceful protest. I guess what I'm trying to get at is do you see any merit to the argument that a strong police presence at a peaceful protest can actually escalate things more than the police not being present at all?
I mean, I think that police are inherently the face of state violence. They are the front line actors that enforce the law, and they enforce the law through the threat of violence or through the exercise of violence. And, you know, anytime you mass a large number of people, frequently in these situations, we're seeing them masked in body armor, maybe carrying riot shields, maybe carrying clubs, frequently carrying guns or gas grenades. That absolutely has the possibility to escalate into violence. And that's really unfortunate. And it's I think that it's a very difficult position for both officers and protesters to be in. Especially when the nature of many of the protests that we're seeing is to protest excessive force by the police, to protest police violence. There have been instances of violence against the police and certainly instances of police violence against the protesters. Basically you just have a powder keg. Everybody's on edge. If you're a police officer and you see a group of people who are, outright furious about police conduct, that may be a frightening situation for an individual young police officer to find themselves in, surrounded and outnumbered. And a major issue that I think recurs is that there's relatively little training to become a police officer in the United States compared to the amount of training that's required in other countries. And so a lot of the officers that you see are young, maybe they're inexperienced, maybe they don't have a significant amount of training. And you also see a career path that personally I find problematic. There's a lot of people moving from the military into the police, and considering that to be a natural progression of their career. But if you think about it, they're really the exact opposite. I mean, the military is a force that's trained for aggression and violence. And I think ideally the police are a force that's trained for de-escalation and protection. But if you're somebody who's received some significant amount of military training experience, and then you become a police officer and you receive several months of police training and then you're out on the street, are you primarily a police officer or are you primarily a soldier wearing a police uniform?
Do you happen to know personally, you mentioned there's a lack of training. Is it the same like other professions where some of the assignments or detail that these cops are doing are due to the lack of experience, they're put on the, you know, quote, undesirable tasks, which one of them is, for example, in Phoenix, going out at, you know, in the hot sun in the summer to monitor a protest. Is that, if you know, is that something that's typically assigned to someone with more rank and experience because they'll be able to handle that better? Or is that assigned to someone lower with less experience and training and time on the job because it's deemed as a less desirable or less important duty?
I mean, I think with regard to the protests, and I'm not positive about this, but I think it's somewhat of an all hands on deck situation. But the, you know, the nature of any profession is that you'll see, you know, a substantial number of people entering the profession, and probably the number of senior people is smaller than the number of junior people, because senior people retire.
I have a question for Logan, and it's about intent with regard to second degree murder charges. So now that officer, Chauvin, he was charged with a new and a more serious count of second degree murder over a week after the death of George Floyd. So it took over a week for them to escalate that charge, just to be clear. So initially he had been charged with third degree murder and second degree manslaughter. The second degree murder charge says he killed Floyd without intent in the course of committing assault in the third degree. So that's listed in the amended complaint. So Logan, I want to talk about, now it says he killed without intent. So it's kind of like the book is shut on that, I guess, unless there's some sort of thing that comes up later. But I just want to talk about what would it take to prove intent in a second degree murder charge? You know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, people being upset that he was charged with second degree because they think that intent won't be able to be proven and that maybe it would have been safer to charge him with third degree. Can you just talk a little bit about that? I mean, what are we looking at here?
Sure. I mean, the relevant intent is the intent to cause death when we're talking about a murder charge. And you know, what would it take to prove it? I mean, I don't know. I viewed the video. It's a horrible thing to watch, and I think it shows a crime. In you know, my estimation, it doesn't show that Officer Chauvin intended to kill Mr. Floyd. It shows him assaulting Mr. Floyd. It shows him acting, I think, with a reckless disregard for Mr. Floyd's safety. But you know, we're talking about an officer who has a gun and a club, and you know, if his plan was that he wanted to kill Mr. Floyd, I think he could have easily accomplished that goal. So, you know, to answer your direct question, what would it take to prove intent? You know, if there were some writings that were uncovered, some journal entry where Officer Chauvin, you know, began to suggest that what he'd like to do is kill someone while he's on duty, or if he had made some utterance, you know, even during the arrest, if he had said, you know, if in response to, I can't breathe, he'd say, that's good, my goal, or I don't want you to breathe, or shut up or I'll kill you. You know, those things would make it look like an intentional killing. Absent those, it looks to me like he didn't really mean to kill Mr. Floyd. He just didn't seem to care all that much if he did.
In a legal point of view, or in terms of the law, I would say, how important or of what weight is Chauvin's background as a police officer going to be taken into account? Because there are, it's all over the internet. There are people who have reported on past misconduct that, you know, Chauvin has done as a police officer in terms of unnecessary use of force. There are documented instances, there are complaints in the past, and it's, I mean, it's more than just a handful of times there. I mean, it's quite a bit. So to what extent would that play a part in the legal system's ruling of whether intent is there or not?
It would probably be most relevant when discussing the officer's training. I think a significant issue that's going to arise in this case is whether the sort of force that was utilized by the officer in this encounter is the sort of force that the officer was trained to utilize when effecting an arrest. And, you know, that if you look at a third degree murder charge in Minnesota, the rule is that whoever, without intent to affect the death of any person, causes the death of another by perpetrating an act eminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind without regard for human life, is guilty of murder in the third degree. So the state will have to prove all elements of the claim. And so they'll have to prove the evidence of a depraved mind and the lack of regard for human life. And I think a relevant question there will be, what is the training? My suspicion, and I'm not particularly familiar with Minnesota police training procedures, but my suspicion is they're not trained to kneel on people's necks for 9 minutes. That's not an approved technique. And I certainly think that if it were an approved technique, that would have filtered down to me through the news. But, you know, take for a second, if that were, then he would maybe have some defense saying, look, I was just doing what I was trying to do. In the alternative, if he tries to make the claim that he was just doing what he was trying to do, then if he has a history of using excessive force on the job, that tends to refute that suggestion, right? You would say, well, no, you weren't just doing what you were trying to do. This is not consistent with your training. And by the way, you know, you are regularly using force that's in excess of your training. And, you know, you seem to disregard it.
I think Wafa's question, and correct me if I'm wrong, Wafa, was more on its own, can that be introduced as a standalone set of facts? And I think the answer to that is no, it can only be used to rebut his contentions. Logan, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the state can't introduce that as dispositive evidence of he clearly intended to kill here because look at this track record.
Right. Well, first of all, there won't be, the state won't introduce evidence attempting to prove that he clearly intended to kill because he's not charged with an intentional killing. But yes, to your point, I believe that the officer's prior bad acts will be inadmissible to show guilt in this scenario. Although there are, you know, there are exceptions to the admissibility of prior bad acts, and that, you know, is, I believe, generally, if the prior bad acts are part of the same crime or demonstrate a pattern of conduct, maybe they're admissible. Honestly, I'd have to look it up. But you know, we really try hard, especially in murder cases, to give defendants a fair shake. We don't want to convict innocent people of murder, and we don't want to say that you did something bad a few years ago and it didn't kill anybody, and therefore you're guilty of murder today. So we'll be, you know, the court will be very careful to limit the sort of evidence of prior bad acts that might be introduced against him in trial, for sure.
So having been both a prosecutor and done criminal defense, how, in your opinion, does the fact that he is a police officer and a defendant shake out? Is there any advantage or disadvantage being prosecuted by the state as an employee of the state as well?
No. I mean, he has the same rights and responsibilities as anybody else. The fact that he used to be a police officer is not going to entitle him to any special treatment in this murder trial.
Of course, it's not going to entitle him to any treatments, but in practice, and again, having been on both sides of the prosecution and the defense, have you seen that there is still an advantage or no? Is the prosecutor very much, you know, by the book typically and uphold his duties to the state and to the people?
So in other words, if it was a friend of George Floyd's that was kneeling on his neck and not Officer Chauvin, you know, if we swap out the defendant, is that essentially where you're going with this, Olin?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's beneficial to be a police officer if you're being prosecuted. And I think generally people have positive opinions about the honesty of police officers. And I think that's, you know, somewhat changing. But, you know, if it comes down to a very close call of credibility about something, the fact that someone is a police officer may tend to help them, may in fact result in jurors giving them some deference. And, you know, as a prosecutor, I certainly observed that police officers who show up to court wearing their uniforms and get up and testify, when it comes to a he said, she said, criminal defense case, word of the officer against word of the accused.
In a bright orange jumpsuit.
Yeah. It's better to be wearing a badge than it is to be wearing handcuffs. It's a better look.
So speaking of the jury, any thoughts, and I don't know the demographics of Minneapolis that well, but any thoughts on how voir dire is going to look here, or the jury selection and what the jury's going to look like that's sitting there judging this case?
Oh, wow. It's going to be a nightmare. One, I think that there will be potentially motions for change of venue. There will be arguments that Officer Chauvin, or Mr. Chauvin, I guess now, is unable to receive a fair trial in Minneapolis, that the issue is just too close to home, and maybe they should try him somewhere else in the state. In terms of voir dire of witnesses, ideally you're going to be looking for witnesses who have limited knowledge of this case, ideally no knowledge of this case, no preconceived notions about who's guilty and who's not guilty. And that's what almost all criminal defendants receive, because almost all crimes receive no significant media attention. And it'll be difficult in this case because there will be lots of people who have read lots of news and also lots of fake news about what's happened.
I mean, I can't imagine there would be a single person in this country who doesn't know about what happened. How is that even possible?
I mean, I don't think that they'll be able to find somebody who doesn't have any knowledge about what happened. But I think that they'll attempt to find people who have limited knowledge. I mean, questions that I'd be asking are, you know, are you a protester? Like, you know, have you been actively engaged in protesting this case? I would probably try to seek to exclude those people from the jury because they clearly have knowledge and strong opinions.
So Logan, you mentioned a potential motion for a change in venue here. And I think the phrase that you used was in order for that to be considered and potentially granted, Mr. Chauvin would have to, or there would need to be evidence that Mr. Chauvin would not receive a fair trial in Minneapolis. So is that the bar that needs to be met? And in your opinion and experience, is that change of venue likely, possible, very unlikely? What would you say?
Yes, that is the bar. And I think that change of venue is highly likely in this case.
Particularly with the protests in Minneapolis, I suppose. I mean, they've got...
But they're limited on where they can go. You can't say, okay, we'll hear this case in Miami now.
No, it's a state law case. It's a state law charge. It has to be tried in a state court in Minnesota.
And so I feel like moving out of Minneapolis to wherever else is not, I mean, it's still, I think it's still so close enough to home where it doesn't change much.
Well, I suspect that Mr. Chauvin's lawyer would say that, I mean, getting out of urban Minneapolis can't be, or is unlikely to be worse than trying the case in an urban Minneapolis court, right? I mean, so even if the jury in, and I'm not familiar with Minnesota, but some more rural town in Minnesota, the crowd will be less enraged potentially in one of those places than in Minneapolis itself. At least that's my sense. I mean, maybe not.
Well, right, that would be the argument. But I think at the end of the day, whether you're in Minneapolis or Bemidji, the people in Minnesota are pretty knowledgeable of what's going on. And it is, of more of a cross-section of the demographic, like you're saying, that whether they're informed or not, I think it's the people who are likely to show up to be on the jury may or may not lean towards, essentially pro-law enforcement or anti, to really boil it down.
I mean, I think the issue is that people in other areas of the state may not have been personally affected by the crime or by the protesting, and especially the riots that occurred afterwards. I mean, people who are obviously going to be improper jury members are people whose businesses were looted in the protesting following the event. That level of personal involvement is really going to cloud somebody's judgment. And it may be that you can relocate it outside of Minneapolis to a place where, yeah, people still know about it because people all over the country know about it. It's on everybody's minds. It's on every news show. But maybe there's a place where you're likely to find a jury pool that is less likely to have been personally affected, maybe have a friend whose business was looted. And then the other issue is, it's a serious crime. It's a serious charge. And we tend to bend over backwards in deference to giving a criminal defendant a fair trial or as close to a fair trial as we can. And also making them believe that they've received a fair trial. And if Officer Chauvin is making a plausible case that he thinks he can't receive a fair trial in Minneapolis, it's better for him to be tried in another area of the state, then why not? I mean, why not grant that motion for change of venue?
So I have a question with regard to the jury, since we're on this topic. And I'm just wondering, you mentioned that obviously it is a state case, has to be tried in a state court. Now, would having a jury from like jurors from different states, say they like cherry picked jurors from all over the country or something like that, is that an option or is that not an option?
No, that's not an option.
Okay. So they have to be from Minnesota.
Yeah, they do.
Gotcha. Do you envision something like that changing? Like, do you envision changes in the legal system with regard to that aspect, given this case or no?
I don't, just because I don't think that there's any constitutional reason that jurors from another state couldn't sit on a jury in a criminal case. I mean, the Constitution entitles you to be
judged by a jury of your peers. The language of your peers has basically been read out of the Constitution as an artifact of English common law, in which a member of the peerage or the aristocracy was entitled to be judged by other members of the aristocracy as opposed to the commoners. But we have no aristocracy in the United States, and I think that the jurisprudence tends to indicate that that was just flowery language, more or less. But as a practical matter, I mean, sitting on a jury is a giant imposition on people's lives. And I know I would not want to get a summons telling me that I need to travel to Minnesota to sit on a jury. I mean, I don't like getting a summons saying I have to travel downtown and take time off work. So if you told me that I needed to fly to another state, I probably wouldn't. It'd just be very difficult to make that work, I think, as a practical
and probably exorbitant on in terms of cost for the state.
Yeah. I would also worry about the people who said yes. I mean, if somebody said, yeah, absolutely, I really want to be on this jury, I'll hop on an airplane. I'll be right there. Well, you know, those people probably have too much at stake in the case.
All right. So now I just want to touch on, Logan, whether you think that we're going to see changes in law enforcement. What sort of changes do you think we're going to see, or are we going to see changes after this case?
I do think that we're going to see changes. And as an aside, I also hope that we're going to see changes. I'm sympathetic on a personal level and informed by my professional experience to the claim that we do have a problem in this country with excessive use of force by the police. I'm sympathetic to the claim that the militarization of the police is not a good way to achieve the public protection and safety goals of the police. And you know, we're talking about so much more than the Floyd case. We're talking about many cases in the news right now that involve exercise of force or no knock warrants. And you know, we're also the defund the police movement has I think some legitimate complaints to make about the increase in the scope of the job that we ask police officers to do on a daily basis. That primarily police should exist to enforce the law and not exist to operate as social workers. Not respond to calls about homelessness or vagrancy or somebody who's emotionally disturbed. Maybe they're not the best people to mediate a domestic dispute. And so I think that there's a real groundswell of support for the idea that we should really look at the sort of policing that we have and see if there's a way to do it better. And I think there probably is a way to do it better. And therefore, I think we probably will see some changes come out of this. And that's, I guess, a silver lining to what happened.
Absolutely. There's always room for improvement. And I couldn't agree more with you that changes do need to happen.
So Logan, you mentioned that police, they exist and their job primarily is to enforce laws, right? And so, part of the issue as we define this broad issue is probably that we have too many criminal laws that police officers are being tasked with enforcing. And you mentioned homelessness is one. So police officers are responsible under some state laws to go and arrest and move homeless people that are violating the law. Maybe that's not the best job for a police officer. Similarly in the drug context, we clearly over the past several decades have had a massive drug problem throughout this country, but maybe the best way to enforce that or fix it, is not to require police to enforce what I think some would call overly broad criminal laws related to drug possession and drug use. So what are your thoughts on police power as a broad concept as far as their responsibility to enforce this, you know, this massive book of criminal laws? You know, how do we walk that back? Do we decriminalize things? Do we shift responsibility off of police but leave laws in place? What does that look like?
I guess I would say yes in response to that. Yeah, I think we should do all of those things. We are addressing a lot through criminal law right now that I think probably isn't most effectively addressed through criminal law. And we're asking the police to perform a lot of tasks that are probably not most effectively performed by an armed and armored, trooper. For instance, we have laws against loitering and vagrancy and public camping. I'm a homeowner. I would be not pleased if a homeless person set up a camp on the sidewalk in front of my house. I really don't want that to happen. And I get why we have some of those laws, but I'm not convinced that the best policy response to that is to have a police officer show up in the same sense that they show up to investigate a home invasion. When we call the police, right now we get a sort of multi-service responder, somebody who is wearing body armor, carrying a pistol, carrying a taser, maybe carrying a club, somebody who has received some training in the use of weapons, some training in clearing buildings, in tactics, training to fight and subdue uncooperative suspects. Maybe that's the person that I want if something goes bump in the night. I believe that somebody's just broken into my home and I'm calling 911. Absolutely, send that person. But if there's, on the other hand, somebody outside who is, mentally unwell, who suffers from some sort of illness, and who's, clearly having an episode, but it doesn't appear to be a violent episode, I think a different sort of responder is ideal for that situation. Somebody who has more training in mental illness and social work and de-escalation, and maybe less training in violence. To some extent, we are where we are because it's difficult and expensive to have the ideal person respond to every sort of call. But to another extent, I think we have to recognize that if the only tool that you have is a hammer, then every problem begins to look like a nail. And with regard to current policing, our police officers receive a lot of training in the use of force because that's really important for their most important job function. The thing that I want the police most for is if someone's trying to hurt me, I want them to come and help me. And I want them to be equipped to use violence in that situation if necessary, because I want them to save me. But being equipped to use violence is not the same as being equipped to deal ideally with any situation. You know, somebody acting disorderly in a Target because they're having a schizophrenic episode, that kind of person probably needs a social worker more than they need a police officer.
Well, I think you're touching on a really important distinction that I've seen multiple times now in the news and both on like social media, is when people talk about this defund the police slogan, essentially, they're not saying abolish. They're saying we need to redistribute the funds that are pumped into the police, as you've aptly pointed out, who are trained to do one thing really well, but expected to do a lot of other things, and send that money to the other areas where the social workers or the caregivers or whoever else is more equipped and better trained to handle the situation should be responding or should be taking that call. And I think, feel free to chime in, but I think that's the, in my understanding and my hope, is the theme and the message behind the defund the police movement. And I guess piggybacking off of that, how do you foresee the change moving towards I've heard of, we don't need police, we need a bunch of sheriffs, or we need a community driven protections rather than a police force. How do you see that practically playing out? And I know it'll probably change, area to area. Downtown Phoenix or Phoenix proper will definitely need a different sort of authority presence than, Casa Grande will, for example.
Sure. So I think that the spin that you give on the defund the police movement is probably the most charitable it's the spin that reflects the most thoughtful advocates within that movement, and the people who I think have the most legitimate concerns. I tend to think that makes up a substantial portion of the movement, but I do think that, in all honesty, there are people out there who just want there to be no more police. And I think they're chanting defund the police as well. I guess I preface my comments with that. In terms of what do we do? I don't know what the solution is, and I'm hesitant to say that what I want the government to do is come up with more bureaucracy to deal with all manner of potential problems. But I think the place that is easiest to start is to decriminalize the sort of behavior that we don't want to be responded to with violence, because every criminal complaint inherently risks violence. And, so I would like to see us decriminalize drugs. I would like to see us have an immigration system that involves much less rounding up of people, and a system that allows peaceful people to pass through borders in pursuit of a better life without the need to sneak across them across private property in the night. I guess I would like us to think very carefully about whether we think that a certain behavior is something that somebody ought not to do, or whether we think it's a behavior that we think that somebody ought to be substantially punished for doing. And I think that a lot of our criminal laws right now exist to deter people with substantial penalties more than they reflect our considered judgment that's the sort of penalty that should be imposed for crime. I'd also like to see us do away with mandatory minimum sentencing. I'd like to see much greater discretion granted to judges, because crimes are individual events, and judges are in an excellent position to make decisions about what an appropriate punishment for the individual standing in front of them is. And you know, I think a lot of mandatory minimum sentences lead to unjust results. So those are, you know, those are the sorts of reforms that I guess I would like to see. And to some extent, I think some of those reforms are really being advocated for right now by some of the protesters. And to that extent, I wish them great success.
I like your point about giving judges more leeway. I think if we allow a judge to make a determination and then you know, kind of go deviate from the mandatory minimums, maximums, and take each case on a individual basis, not only does it allow for a real subjective view on an objective event, but I think it also will in turn play out well, because judges are elected. And if a judge is routinely, you know, quote, being too light on criminals or too heavy handed, that will be reflected at the next election cycle. You know, the community will get together and say, hey, you know, we need to be a little more stern with what kind of sentences we're putting down for X, Y, and Z, or, hey, this guy's overbearing. And I think the community will speak. And I think that kind of will lead to that sort of progress that you're talking about. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
All right. Well, that was very, very insightful. Thank you guys for that. We're going to go into part two of this episode, and that is covering freedom and free speech. So just like I mentioned earlier, our country, the United States of America, was founded on the principle of freedom and free speech. And millions of people have dedicated their lives to the pursuit of maintaining a free democratic society that allows people to express themselves without fear of retaliation from the government. It's what sets us apart on the world stage, and it's something that needs to be protected at all costs. The First Amendment to the United States Constitution is a part of the United States Bill of Rights that protects freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, and a right to petition, which is essentially the right to peaceful protest. Now, with that in mind, we're going to discuss the scope of freedom and free speech as it applies to the recent events. And I want to kick it off with Olin. Olin, why don't you talk a little bit about how freedom and free speech go hand in hand with internet privacy and Logan's expertise?
Logan and I have done some work with internet privacy, internet defamation, and it's sort of a new frontier, a new realm of a, you know, centuries old constitutional cornerstone in the way that the law views it, because it interlays not only legal rights and legal remedies, but also technological considerations as well. And it's an interesting area because it's unventured, it's new, and the way you think about it, the way we've traditionally thought about these things is kind of being reconsidered and almost repaved and redrafted. The First Amendment is kind of changing in at least in the cyberspace universe.
Logan, do you want to talk to us a little bit about your experience with that?
I do a lot of internet defamation work, and this is a practice area that's been growing over the past few years. I mean, defamation law certainly goes back to English common law. It's been with us for a very long time, but it's only been more recently that individuals have the ability to very widely publish their own thoughts. They can publish them to the world at virtually no cost and instantaneously. And that's led to, unfortunately, a lot of defamation. Some people have used their freedom to advance political discussions or to share knowledge or to entertain. But other people have chosen to use these new tools to damage businesses, malign their competitors, seek revenge from their ex-girlfriends, any number of mean-spirited things have been done. And sometimes defamation is done for extortionist purposes. I've seen people post horrible things about others online for the purpose of getting that person to pay them to remove the post. And this is an area of the law that is evolving, and it's one that that seeks to balance our right to free speech against our right not to be defamed. Historically, let me take a step back. A lot of defamation, in fact, almost all of it that I see is done anonymously. Very seldom do people publish their true identity and then tie it to defamatory statements. And in fact, some defamation is more effective by virtue of being anonymous or at least pseudonymous. If I write that a pizza restaurant routinely uses expired pepperoni, old cheese, that I saw their owner dumpster diving behind the Albertsons for ingredients, that I've received food poisoning from there, that's much more persuasive if you don't know that I own a competing pizza restaurant.
I know that pizza place you're talking about, by the way.
Definitely.
Don't go to my go pizza there. Place.
Prepare to call it out.
So people have an incentive to hide their identity. But we also have a right to speak anonymously. Going back to the founding of the country under the Federalist Papers, Hamilton, Madison, Jay, they published the Federalist Papers pseudonymously under the name Publius. We consider those almost to be founding documents of the United States. And we consider that sort of political speech to be important. And we consider the right of people to speak on ideas when they're private people without really wanting to thrust themselves into the public light to be an important part of our democracy. So in internet defamation, frequently the bigger battle is to uncover the identity of the person who posted the defamation more than it is to actually establish the defamatory nature of the material that's been posted. And that's something that I do.
Right. Logan, I want to circle back real quick. I want you to shed some light on how do we walk the line between freedom of speech, expressing yourselves just like we have the right to do, and essentially, I guess my question is, where do we draw the line in terms of free speech? I mean, you see people out peacefully protesting, but you also see people out looting and rioting. And while we made sure to express that protesting is not looting, some people might think that looting or rioting is in a way expression. How do we walk the line between that? I know it's kind of controversial and stuff like that, but I mean, how do we really define that in this situation?
So we don't have absolutely free speech, and we certainly do have limitations on it. And I think those limitations are difficult, and the line is fine. I mean, the typical law school example is we don't think it's okay for somebody to yell fire in a crowded theater. On one hand, you would say, well, that's just speech. It's free speech. On the other hand, that speech has very little value when there's no fire, and it has a whole lot of risk. It risks the people in the theater getting up and trampling each other to escape from a fire that doesn't even exist. So we tend to say that should be a restriction on free speech, or defamation is a restriction We have obscenity laws that, as an aside, I oppose. And you make a good point, which is that some of the protesting actually is the looting and the rioting, and that there's a real element of speech to that. And there's a group of people who have said, look, you know, we have peacefully protested, and you haven't listened. And only when we do violence or only when we do property damage do we receive the sort of attention and reaction that we're looking for. And I think they're right to an extent that those sorts of actions do get more attention. But I also think that we're right to say, no, speech needs to be peaceful. You have a right to express your opinion, but you don't have a right to burn down my business as a microphone for your opinion. You know, you don't have a right to throw Molotov cocktails to gain attention for your opinion. That's not the sort of discourse that we want to further in our society, because we don't want it to be the case that anytime somebody has a point to make, even if it's a valid point, that they make it at the expense of other people.
But is free speech used as an affirmative defense to the violation of another law, or is it being used as a per se example of a expression under the First Amendment?
I'm not aware of any attempts to use the right of free speech as a defense to a criminal charge for rioting or looting. And I also do not believe that that would be an effective or winning defense. I think it's pretty clear that we don't allow people to engage in violence in furtherance of their speech.
There are a lot of people out there who are really questioning the rule of law, and they're saying that, oh, you and your officer didn't per se follow the rules when it comes to apprehending a suspect. Okay. Like, I mean, obviously he didn't, right? The guy died in custody. So if you're not going to follow the rules, why should we? What do you say to people like that?
I think that's actually a really interesting question. I guess I'd like to dovetail it into a broader philosophical point, which is, now, when is violent rebellion appropriate? And it's a difficult question to answer. I tend to think that violent rebellion against the state is appropriate if the state is behaving violently, violating your rights, and if there is no peaceful democratic method available to you to change the state's behavior, and you do not have the opportunity to leave. And I think that as long as there are peaceful means available to you to change the system, or if the system is so egregious and unchangeable that you can leave and seek a better life elsewhere, then I really don't think that you should do violence. And I also, as an aside, don't think that the level of violence that we see in this country done by the state nears the level of violence that, in my estimation, would justify violent rebellion. I think we have a real problem with excessive use of force by the police, and I want it to stop. But I also think that we live in a very safe society. Regardless of what maybe is being portrayed, your absolute risk of being assaulted or murdered by the state is extremely low. And it's a horrible thing when it happens, but it doesn't appear to me that it's happening frequently enough that it excuses, burning down police stations.
And I completely agree with you at the latter part of that statement, but is it true that your risk of being assaulted or murdered by the police is equally the same for every citizen in the United States or every person in the United States, or is it disproportional depending on who you are, where you come from, and maybe that's part of the outrage that we're seeing?
It is absolutely true that your risk of receiving violence from the state is not equal across population groups. And there are different ways to parse the division, racially, socioeconomically, geographically. All of those are important. My understanding of the statistics, for instance, is that you're approximately 220 times more likely to be killed by the police if you're a person of color in the United States than if you are a white person. However, your absolute risk of being killed by the police, regardless of those factors, is low. Very, very low.
Do you think we will ever get to a point where that number you just gave, the 200 number, is less than one? And if so, how do we get there?
Wow, that's a difficult question. I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see that happen. I think that there are a number of explanatory factors for the difference. I don't know if we will. I certainly don't believe that we'll get to a point where we will be able to equalize the socioeconomic risk of violence between classes, because there appears to be a correlation between poverty and crime. And I don't think that we'll be able to disassociate crime from the risk of violence by the police. But I think it's the wrong question and the wrong focus. I understand why people are upset. I do, and I'm sympathetic. But I think at least in my estimation, what we want to do is focus on reducing the excessive use of force by police, period. And not focus on how to achieve some sort of parity if police just started killing white people unjustifiably at a higher rate in order to match what they're doing to people of color. I don't think that'd be a better situation, even though it might be an equitable situation. I just want them to stop using excessive force.
I mean, I like your answer. I think that's well put. I think it's a greater greater issue that's being parsed down to the more narrow focus presently. But I think on the whole, it's a systemic problem that is solved through not just the current climate that we're seeing, and not the issues in the current climate that we're seeing, but the greater changes that need to be made, both in the administration of the policing powers and society's view of their roles and responsibilities.
Well, and I don't think that the issue is solved or even properly addressed necessarily by placing blame on police officers specifically. I mean, on an individual case by case basis, absolutely. And I'm, you know, as you know, we've talked about earlier, you know, Mr. Chauvin needs to, you know, there needs to be justice for, you know, what we saw on that video and what Mr. Floyd, you know, the actions that killed Mr. Floyd. But I think that from a broader perspective, the approach should be, let's not push blame on individual police officers, but let's address why this is happening, right? So if police officers are being undertrained, for example, Logan, you mentioned this earlier, or they're being trained in the wrong ways, and that focus needs to shift. Let's take a hard look at those training programs and or, you know, if the police favors applicants who have a military background, maybe that needs to change. And I think that we can put the problem in front of us, but I feel that, you know, too often, especially as we're, you know, become more and more of a polarized society, we tend to just place immediate blame and say, you know, cut it out, stop it, period. But that I don't think that this is an issue that can be solved by placing blame and telling police officers to stop using excessive force. I think it needs we need to address it from the back forward, if that makes sense.
Logan, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of just final comments, anything you want to pitch, anything you want to say about your work at Rose Law Group. Really just kind of open the mic up to you just for a little bit at the end.
Let me plug myself and my philosophy and a little bit of what I do. I do civil litigation work, as I mentioned. I am primarily an attorney who goes to court and resolves disputes through court. But I'm also an attorney who would recommend to you that you do everything you can to avoid litigation. I think, you know, my general philosophy is that litigation is extremely expensive, stressful, uncertain, time consuming. And I do everything that I can to settle disputes, to try to find creative solutions to disputes, rather than try to drag my clients through years of litigation. But, you know, if litigation is the only option, then, you know, that's where I make my money and I enjoy doing it. So I'm more than happy to do it. I also, as I mentioned, I do misdemeanor criminal defense. I do it mostly just as a passion project. I particularly enjoy doing DUI defense. I think in Arizona, the police are substantially over-aggressive in handing out DUIs, and I see a lot of injustice there. And I very much enjoy defending those cases. And I'm also, in my personal life, I'm a firearms enthusiast, and I've gotten into weapons that are regulated by the National Firearms Act, including silencers, short-barreled rifles, short-barreled shotguns, and machine guns that are manufactured and registered before May of 1986. All of those things are legal to own and possess, but their transfer is highly regulated and taxed by the federal government, and I help people to sort of navigate the rules and regulations associated with that, and I prepare a trust for them to hold those weapons, which provides some level of assistance to them in going through the process and in holding the weapons. So if anybody out there has a dispute that they, you know, would rather settle, or one that they'd rather go to the mat and fight, or if they've been accused of a minor crime, I tend to not like to do felony defense, but misdemeanor defense I quite enjoy. Or if you want to get a a really nice weapon. I can help you with those things, and I'd love to talk to you.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Logan. That was awesome. To our audience, thank you so much for listening to this episode. While these issues may not be easy to discuss, they are very important to discuss. And we're honored that you're engaging with us in this dialogue. After all, it is increased dialogue that will allow for increased understanding and hopefully increased unity in this time of stark division. And with that, I again want to thank Logan for being our guest. And please continue to tune into our podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram at The Rose Report Pod, on Facebook at The Rose Report Podcast, on Twitter at The Rose Report Podcast, or even by just shooting us an email at rosereportpod@gmail.com. Please do connect with us and let us know your thoughts. We want to hear from you, good and bad. Thanks again. Stay safe and healthy out
there. Epstein didn't kill himself.
Yeah, I just want to thank everyone. I just want to thank everyone for tuning in as well. As Wafa pointed out, these are heavy and difficult issues to discuss, but I hope that with our curation here, we've at least made some of the points and their ramifications and their explanations a bit easier to digest. And hopefully you walk away with a better understanding of the issues, regardless of which, what side of the issues you're on.
Well, and as you got a taste of today, Logan is a fascinating person to talk to, and knows a lot, knows a lot about a lot of subjects. I was going to say a little about a lot of subjects, but that's not true.
It is true.
So, he
knows a few things.
But please do, to our listeners, please do reach out. We were saying offline that we definitely do want to have Logan back on. So if there are topics that you want to hear Logan talk about, questions that you want Logan to answer, please reach out to us. We'll link his information in the description for this podcast as well. But thanks for tuning in, everyone.